Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Hank. I am also now officially an iTunes podcaster.
Am I going to have to retype my card?
Yeah, to add to it. Well, yes, thanks to my intern, Ashlyn, hard work this summer, you can now podcast shows on iTunes. That means you can download them onto your devices and carry them with you, which is a little different than when you go to my website or the kcbx.org website. You have to be streaming on your computer while it's actively turned on. So for those of you who don't know about the podcasting world, I'm learning. It's a great way to kind of store shows for listening to on your walks or on your drives or other times that you don't have access to the internet. So I'm very excited about that. And thanks to Ashlyn. You have to just look up The Reluctant Therapist under the podcasts. And you can also always find our shows at kcbx.org. And you can find out about what's coming up on the program through our Facebook page, Reluctant Therapist, or our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. Lots of ways to stay connected. And I always enjoy receiving emails at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com to know what's going on for you, what struck a chord, or what's on your mind. Because not everybody wants to call in and share their story, and I understand that, although it does make for a more lively discussion if we have it on the air and more people can participate. And the thing that I always want to remind you is if there's something you're thinking about, if there's something you feel like, oh, I want to pick up the phone and call, I can pretty much assure you that there are a lot of people having those same thoughts or same concerns or same issue. And when you call and share them, a lot of people benefit from your experience because it normalizes for them their experience to feel like they're not as alone in what's going on in their lives or to hear someone else's perspective. I mean, that really is the point of the show week after week, is to provide this forum of opportunity to share our concerns and our joys and our triumphs and all those things that go on in our lives day to day, because that's really what we're here for. We're here to be in community as humans and individuals. We're not really supposed to be kind of isolated and on our own and trying to figure things out day to day in our own little world. And oftentimes that's what gets us into trouble, is that extended period of time that we spend alone with our own thoughts, without a lot of feedback from others, without a lot of confirmation of our existence. That's how mental health and mental illness sneak up on us, when we spend too much time away from those who support our journey. We start to lose our grip. We start to disconnect from the fabric of society. And that ties into directly what we're going to talk about today. And, you know, I apologize a little bit up front because it's not going to be a light or, upbeat conversation today, although hopefully we'll find some things that are hopeful in the conversation. But I think it's a conversation that we really need to have because it strikes every community in some way. It strikes families in some way. And it's an issue that is a concern across the country, and especially as we go back into the school year and we send our children off to their campuses, whether it be preschool, elementary school, high school, or university campuses, in hopes and faith that everyone else who's coming to the campus is mentally fit and healthy and okay to be on campus and able to function. What I'm talking about is gun shootings. Shootings, gun violence, shootings on campuses, and just gun violence in general. I want to talk about this link that's made quite often every time there is some sort of shooting incident. And most recently, I'm thinking about the two reporters last week who were gunned down on assignment. And that really struck me. That got to me on a deep level because I thought, you know, this is becoming like the Wild West. You know, that this is happening on a daily basis. I read a CNN poll, their gun violence project, that stated that 80 people will die in a 24-hour period from gun violence. That's every day. 80 people every day. That if we stacked up the amount of people who had been killed by the use of guns over the last 25, 30 years, it would triple the amount of people that died serving our country in Vietnam. And so we have a problem with gun violence, but we also tend to jump to this link between everyone who commits an act of violence with guns is mentally ill. And I think that is a link that's easy to make, because I can't imagine anyone in their right mind going in and shooting others, right? And so there is some level of mental disturbance that causes someone to go into any situation and shoot innocent people. I understand that. But we have to look at how we define mental illness, or what we consider to be someone who's mentally ill, because there are some nuanced differences in definitions that I think keep us from really focusing on some of the primary issues that are related to gun violence that are overlooked, because we quickly say, well, this person was mentally ill, and as long as we're not mentally ill, we don't have to worry about violence or gun violence. And I think that that's where we get into trouble. So today I want to talk about gun violence. I want to talk about mental health and well-being, and I want to talk about the underlying factors that go into someone committing acts of violence. And I think that's where you might be a little surprised, or maybe even a little more concerned, because one of the things that I discovered in researching this topic was that small, idyllic communities such as ours tend to be ripe for gun violence and violent shootings and violent outbursts by adolescent males or young men. And we're going to talk about why is that? Why that places that are considered small town, idyllic, the perfect quiet place to raise a family are some of the more common places that this kind of behavior that leads to gun violence erupts. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You'll be invited to be part of this conversation, as always, at 805-781-3875. If you have a thought on this or anything you'd like to share, I'll open the phone lines in a few minutes. But I'd like to try to lay out my argument a little bit, so follow along with me, of how I got to this place. So I started out just wanting to talk about gun violence and mental illness, because I assume, just like many people, that all perpetrators of gun violence are mentally ill. But as I started to read the information, as a therapist, I reminded myself that there's a wide spectrum when it comes to mental health and mental illness. And one of my concerns overriding since we started doing this show is that we lump all mental illness into one category, that we don't understand that there's a wide spectrum, a wide range of how we define mental health. And so understanding this spectrum is really important in understanding the link between gun violence and mental health. So the first side of the spectrum, or the far end of the spectrum, would be what we would consider severe mental disorders like schizophrenia, psychosis, a severe depression or bipolar disorder. You know, those are chronic, severe mental illnesses that inhibit our capacity to function. Not to say that when properly medicated, a lot of people at the severe end of the spectrum can't function and enjoy their lives. But that level of mental illness is kind of the far end of the spectrum, the more difficult to treat, the more chronic. But it also doesn't mean that these people are more prone to violence. As a matter of fact, they are not. Only 4% of the gun shootings occurred by people who were suffering from severe mental illness as their only factor. There might have been mental illness in all of the shooters, and we're going to talk about that, but the mental illness is only one piece of it. But when you looked at the shootings where the only factor was mental health, only 4% were by those who had been diagnosed with severe mental illness. And that's across the board, that those with severe mental illnesses are not more prone to violent outbursts or violent behavior than the regular population. And unfortunately, when they do polls, people actually believe, 80% of the population believes, that mental illness is to blame for shooting incidents. And so as soon as we say that, you know, the lack of health care and the lack of treatment for those that are mentally ill is the cause of gun shootings, we immediately stop addressing all of the other factors that go into it. So one end of the spectrum, severe mental illness. And then the other end of the spectrum, we have, you know, disruptive transitions, maybe going through grief, a breakup, loss of employment. You know, those as normal glitches in the human life that cause us to struggle for a period of time and can cause us to feel anxious or depressed or angry or, you know, OCD. We can go through periods of time where we struggle going through different issues. So that's on the far end. And then there's a lot of areas in between. Some people struggle with depression at different levels for longer variances of time. Some people have anxiety to different levels of severity, but it is all on the spectrum. One of my concerns is that when we diagnose and treat people all in one big category, you're starting to address, especially in young people, normal developmental disorders or more normal developmental struggles, because it's common to go through periods of anxiety and depression when you're young. It's common for young children to be oppositional and defiant. They're growing and learning what the boundaries are. You know, it's not uncommon for all adolescents to go through these experiences. But we've gotten ourselves to a place that every time a young person shows any of these symptoms, and we're starting as young as preschool in diagnosing children with bipolar disorder and these really severe mental illnesses, when, you know, we don't know developmentally where that child's going. So we've started to diagnose younger children and adolescent children at larger amounts we've diagnosed them at greater numbers. And so we're starting to see this connection between all depression, all anxiety, all OCD, all ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, as being part of this severe mental health spectrum. And it's not. So that's one problem, is that we have to look at this spectrum to understand what's going on when it comes to violence. And so if we understand that violent acts are not necessarily committed by those with severe mental illnesses, and we put that aside, then we have to start understanding what are the other things that drive violent behaviors. And the thing that we overlook are the social contexts. We don't look at the psychological, psychosocial issues that drive and drove the young men that committed school shootings to do what they did. So I looked at a couple of studies. One was by Jeffrey Swanson he's a professor at Duke University, and he has done kind of the premier studies on the connection between mental illness and gun shootings, gun violence. And he's the one that found that really there were greater factors in what led someone to gun violence than severe mental illness. He said that really the issues of violence in their past, experiencing violence in their past, poverty, being a male, unfortunately, you know, almost 99% of these shootings, this mass violence, is perpetrated by young males. So being a male, in poverty, unemployed, drug and alcohol abuse, and having been victimized violently themselves, all of these factors were much greater indicators of potential violence than severe mental illness. But the other thing that he found is that, or that he didn't talk about, is that when you look at the Columbine incidents or Adam Lanza or all of the school shooters of the last 15 years and the young man who did the shootings in Santa Barbara last year, they all had been treated for some sort of disorder when they were young, either ADHD, they're on Ritalin or on Zoloft or on Paxil, some sort of psychotropic medication for something that we would consider more on the lower moderate scale of mental health concerns, right, for ADHD or for depression and anxiety. So they all were medicated or had been on medications at some time for these more low-level mental health concerns. So Jeffrey Swanson's takeaway was that really in order to look at gun violence and the use of guns or how we are going to develop our gun policies, that it was much more important to look at previous acts of violence as indicators of future violence and drug and alcohol abuse than really strictly looking at mental health. So that's Jeffrey Swanson's. And then I came across the book by a book called Rampage, and it was written by Catherine Newman. And that book really started taking the conversation in another direction for me. Because to be honest, when I went into thinking I really want to do this conversation, I really was going to concentrate on the mental health piece. And I really wanted to dig into this whole idea that we're diagnosing children with unnecessary, you know, we're diagnosing unnecessarily with disorders that really could be treated without medications. I wanted to go down that path, especially after reading the list of all of the young people who had committed crimes while on Prozac and Ritalin. It's just Ritalin. Kip Kinkle, who shot his parents, you might remember him, was on Prozac and Ritalin. And then the shooters from Columbine, Ron Zoloft and Lovox. I wanted that to be the connection, because I have page after page of young people under the age of 25 down to the age of 11 who had been diagnosed and put on Ritalin and various psychiatric drugs and ended up committing gun violence. I wanted that to be the link. But then I realized after reading Catherine Newman's book, Rampage, that that was too narrow of the conversation. That narrowed the conversation too much. That is a piece of it, but the diagnosis of these young men and the subsequent putting them on prescriptions was really just another part of our social context, our psychosocial misunderstanding of what it is to be a young man in culture today. It was just another way that we are pushing under the rug or trying to lump mental illness into one big category and ignoring some of the really key factors that drove all of these young people to get to a place where they were prescribed medication or ended up committing violent acts. But I also don't want to dismiss the connection, and it is well documented, that being on Prozac, Ritalin, Paxil, a lot of these psychotropic drugs have been linked to suicidal ideations and violence, but more so suicidal ideation. If you want to look at a link of gun violence, there's a huge link between suicide and guns and psychotropic drugs. There's a huge link between committing suicide while on these prescription drugs. But that's another conversation. But I want to go back to Catherine Newman's book. And if you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And today I'm trying to address in some way the connection between gun violence and that link to mental health. Or where I'm hoping that we're going to go is, how do we address the social, psychosocial factors that can lead to gun violence and lead to mental health concerns or mental health issues that could lead to gun violence? Because I really think that we're only scratching the surface when we talk about gun violence and mental illness. I think the psychosocial factors are much more, are much bigger than we understand. And if you'd like to be part of this conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. I'd love to hear from you, anything that's come up for you at this point or thoughts you have. 805-781-3875. All right, so Catherine Newman's book, Rampage, she looked at the school shootings and, you know, 34 different school shootings, and went, and I think she was working on a government commission to look at what were the common factors. And she did a lot of research into what were the common denominators in a lot of these different mass shootings. And the first thing she said was, of course, they were all committed by young men. The second thing was that they all happened in small communities, in small, tight-knit kind of communities that would be considered idyllic, the place you'd want to raise your children, where everybody knows everyone's business. But she said it was also ripe for anyone who's marginalized, who doesn't fit in, who doesn't find their place within the community, to feel alienated, to feel ostracized, to become bullied. Being bullied was also a common denominator, that a lot of these young men had been bullied at some time through life when they were younger and felt outside of the mainstream. And she said, so inadvertently, these small town communities tend to have a very closed off way of dealing with each other, that there was very narrow definition of what was normal and what was okay. So if you were on the football team or on a sports team, if you were pretty and talented, you were recognized as fitting in or having a place. But if you didn't, if you were the awkward, shy, a little different, didn't have any, gifts that were noticeable, weren't a star in some way, that it was easy to be dismissed and kind of overlooked or overshadowed and pushed aside. And so then the small communities These shooters all felt marginalized in some way and ended up, you know, retreating in some ways into their homes, becoming loners. So that's the other common denominator, that 75% of these shooters were considered loners. They were outside of the mainstream, not with a group of friends. The other piece she found was that the 61% were involved in substance abuse of some kind, were abusing drugs and alcohol, but also many of them were on prescription meds of some kind. 48% of these young men were preoccupied with weapons, and 43% had been bullied in some way. So these psychosocial problems of being in these small communities where there's a very narrow definition of what was right and what was normal and how to fit in and how to find your people had kind of started this path towards mental instability. The other thing she found were that some of the shooters had these kind of fantasy of being seen as a notorious anti-hero, and that there was a lot of use of video games. And it's interesting because that doesn't come up in the gun violence conversations about the obsession with violent video games. As a matter of fact, there's been as many researched reports paid for by video game creators to say that video game violence doesn't impact behaviors, as there are studies saying that violent video games do impact violent behavior. But if we're just using our common sense, I don't know if we can deny that sitting inside playing violent video games all day long is not going to have some impact on our view of ourselves or our mental stability or how we view the world in general. So you take these young men who already feel marginalized, they retreat to their homes, they get involved in drug and alcohol abuse and spending a lot of time in this kind of fantasy world of revenge and being an anti-hero, and you're starting to sow the seeds of some violent outbursts. 805-781-3875. This is a conversation, and you're welcome to be part of it. Steve, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, I just had a couple of questions. I'm wondering, on the studies that you looked at, how do they separate out the fact that these are higher-risk individuals to begin with that are put on the drugs like Ritalin or the antidepressants, Zoloft and such, as you mentioned? You know, in other words, you could look at studies that show people on chemotherapy die a lot, you know, from cancer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the chemotherapy was the cause for their death, but ultimately the cancer was. A lot of high-risk kids are going to be put on these medications, and then they're going to therapeutically fail, and how do you separate that out?
That's a great conversation point, Steve, because I think one of the things we assume is that once we put these kids on the drugs and on the medications, that we're taking care of the issues. And so I think it is hard to separate out, because if we don't have follow-up, right, if we don't do the therapy, we don't have the social support, we don't address the other factors that are leading to this child being at higher risk. And I'm curious what you mean by higher risk also. I mean, higher risk to violent behavior, higher risk to themselves. How do you define that?
Oh. Or schizophrenia.
I'm sorry, can you say it again? See if I missed the beginning.
Yeah, I don't mean by higher risk kids, I mean higher risk for psychosis, like bipolar disorder or major depression or schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And it seems like therapists are going to be more likely to start with the lesser strength drugs as opposed to the higher antipsychotics anyway. So it gets awfully complicated.
It does. And so the hard thing is for me, because I'm a family therapist by training, so we don't write prescriptions. It has to come from a psychologist psychiatrist. And so a lot of times, you know, parents, their child is struggling and they want to get the best help and they immediately go to psychiatrists. And more often than not, psychiatrists are going to write a medical prescription right off the bat.
Exactly.
So we're already in trouble, because once you write one prescription, especially for young children, you know, if they don't work, we don't generally take the kids off. They generally add more prescriptions on top of it. So now what's the chicken and the egg problem? Have we sent this child down a path where the medications are increasing their risk, right? Because the side effects are huge. Or was this a child that was already going to struggle all along and the meds, you know, aren't really the underlying factor? We don't know, because we're not really doing the other work to help these children reduce their risk. Now, schizophrenia,
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
I was saying, with schizophrenia, you know, that's not something that we do preventative medications for. There's usually a psychotic break of some point, you know, where the schizophrenic symptomology becomes apparent. So we're very, you know, we're not doing preventative work. So if a child, you know, presents with ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, or major anxiety, or even low-level anxiety, we're quick to throw them on medications in a way to try to address the symptomologies. But what we're not doing, and this is the ongoing problem, is we're not doing the follow-up pieces, are making sure that they're socialized, making sure that their family system is stable, making sure that they are engaged in activities, right? All those things that are going to stabilize them. And so there's so many places that we're dropping the ball. It's hard to know, as you said, are the meds causing the problem or were they going to have problems anyway? We don't have a holistic measure.
And then there's another category of people that aren't talked about because it's not, I don't know, politically correct, but there's many people that are very much helped by Ritalin, people, you know, kids with ADHD that that are able to focus and have that executive function of their brain work and are able to become focused, good students. There's a lot of kids with significant depression that are really helped by antidepressants. And it's not a black and white issue to me. I think that we tend to want to put blame on medications when these medications have been very, very helpful in a lot of people.
And I agree. And I think that's what makes the conversation so difficult, because for every one of the children or young people that are helped by use of these meds, how do we address all the kids that aren't helped? And now we've got them down a rabbit hole where they're on meds that were never should have been prescribed and have gotten them in more trouble than help. I mean, I think that's always my concern, is that I don't want to diminish the positives, but the research shows that there are a great deal of young people that are overprescribed. And these are studies that have been put out in the last 5 years by the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association, both associations are backing down what they've been doing for 15 years. So that's why I think it's a conversation that needs to be had, because how much collateral damage do we have to go through for those that are getting help?
I agree. And I just want to tell you, I listened to your show driving between patients, and you do a terrific job. I always appreciate what you have to say.
Steve, thanks so much for taking the time to call in. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, 805-781-3875. Hi, Carl. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
I was curious what the difference between schizophrenia and bipolar disorder is, and if it's possible to have both of those symptoms active at once.
So co-occurring disorders, you can have multiple diagnoses. Anyone can, that you can struggle with different things. But schizophrenia is going to be more characterized by hallucinations, voices in the head, a psychotic break from reality, kind of being separated out, so on a more severe level. Bipolar disorder tends, by definition, to be a cycling between mania and deep depression. And they can be rapid cyclings where you're in a manic episode, where you're up for days on end and feeling like you're Superman and can, you know, do everything, then dropping into this dark, dark, deep depressed place. And so that's, it used to be called, you know, the bipolar disorder was manic depression. It's had different definitions over the years. But the two, you know, there can be hallucinations with bipolar disorder, but schizophrenia tends to be more connected to the psychotic break, and bipolar tends to be more with the varying of the mood disorders.
Okay, so it probably has a bipolar dominant illness, so it could possibly be like a bipolar disorder with schizophrenic tendencies, possibly.
And there's so many things that can play into it. Diagnoses are very complex because there's nothing very simple. The other thing that's interesting to look at is that a lot of people will be diagnosed with depression, and then, you know, a few years later will be diagnosed with bipolar disorder because manic episodes will occur. And then quite often what we don't address is that abuse of alcohol and drugs can lead to manic episodes, which can kick into a bipolar disorder diagnosis. And the thing is, and aside from schizophrenia, which and bipolar disorder, which tend to be lifelong struggles and lifelong illnesses, they don't stay consistent. We vary how these illnesses impact the psyche. And so it's not like... it's not like a physical illness where you have this and we understand the progression. Mental illness is much more fluid, and so understanding how to treat people and what medications, it takes a lot of vigilance and constant care to help people stay stable in with both of those disorders.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your information. I love your show, by the way.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for calling in. Okay. And Jeff, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm curious if there have been any studies looking at the publication or getting the word out about the mass killers' story as a motivation for what they do.
Explain more.
Well, for instance, the young man in Santa Barbara who, you know, ran over some people with his car and he knifed some and he shot some, you know, his story was told in the media and, you know, everybody found out about what he thought about so many different topics, and he was studied and evaluated and publicized. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about the notoriety afterward, and if there's any studies about the effect that has on somebody trying to perpetrate a big event like this.
Like the copycat.
Yeah, are they looking for the notoriety or finally be heard? And you know, part of my thought is, what if people did something, a thing like this, and were never heard from again?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much is the notoriety a factor, a cause of these kinds of behaviors?
And so I don't have statistically numbers, and I'm just taking, you know, the book that I talked about, Rampage by Catherine Newman, who spent 2 years exploring these common factors between all the shooters, and she did say that, you know, there in the shooter's mind there was this fantasy of being seen as a notorious anti-hero, that I don't have the young man's name in front of me, but he had been, you know, really trying to fit in at school to make friend groups and had been kind of teased or left out. And he wanted to be cool with one of the groups. So he brought his dad's gun to school to show them. And the kids just kind of laughed at him and said, "That's not a real gun. Bring a shotgun." And so he brings a shotgun, and then he starts, you know, seeing that he's getting attention for this. And then, you know, that fantasy of kind of being the lone gunman and I'll show them, it does start to play into building of this kind of this delusion or this isolated illusion that they're actually fitting in some way, in this anti-hero way, and this idea that I'll show them, that definitely plays into it. I think there's been conversation of, well, what if we never publicize them? We'll take away the hero piece of it, and so that we won't have copycats. I think there's some validity in that. But I think that what we need to be talking about is how similar all these stories are. These stories of not fitting in, being bullied, trying to find where they are in the school. And when they don't get that feedback or they don't find that connection, then it starts to lead to the violent behavior. And then at the bottom of her list is, you know, the availability of the weapons, that having access to the guns is a key piece in all of these shootings. If they didn't have access to the guns, there might have been violence in other ways, but it wouldn't have been mass shootings. So the accessibility of the guns played into the hero fantasy. Did I go where you were going?
Sure. Well, and I was just curious because my theory is that in the media, when these issues are discussed, the media tends to be very blind to their own impact on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
The stories that I hear tend to be a lot about all kinds of other causes, mm-hmm, other than the media itself.
Well, what I was going to say, Jeff, isn't it interesting because the media is kind of like an adolescent trying to fit in and get attention. You know, if you look at
right.
it from a bigger perspective, all the media wants is to get the ratings and to be popular and to be the best loved of all media outlets. And so why wouldn't they want to glorify themselves and be, you know what I'm saying, sensational?
Right.
Like, they're an adolescent themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you.
Thanks for calling in, Jeff. I appreciate your thoughts. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you're just tuning in, this is Public Radio KCBX in a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can be part of the conversation by calling in at 805-781-3875. We have a Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. We are now on iTunes. We tweet. I try to tweet. And I always love your emails to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com and your thoughts on anything that's going on in your life. And today, we're talking about gun violence and mental illness. And I started off wanting to find this link because I was really, I'm always been concerned that when you look at the shooters from Columbine, from Adam Lanza, from almost every school shooting we've ever had, from the young man who walked into the movie theater in Colorado, there are similarities. One was that almost every one of them was on some sort of medication for anxiety or depression or ADHD, Zoloft, Paxil, Ritalin. They are there. And so I wanted to talk about that as being the issue that that drove these young men to committing such violent acts because of the unintended consequences and side effects of the medication. But in doing more research and coming across the book by Catherine Newman, I really started to focus on the social cultural issues, the things that these young men had in common in the places that they grew up, in their small communities, in these communities that are considered idyllic, the best place to raise a child, ended up being oppressive for these young men. They couldn't find a place where they belonged. They couldn't find their peer group. They felt marginalized. They felt isolated. They retreated into their own kind of worlds of fantasy. And the other thing that was a common factor, and this is something that should concern us all, is that there was no communication between the different agencies in these small towns. You know, no one was willing to stand up. And we talk about it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village that's willing to speak up. And so the counselor had some indication that something wasn't right. A teacher had an indication that something wasn't right. A neighbor had noticed some violent behavior. The school psychologist had seen this young man. All of these people never communicated to each other, and they didn't reach out to the parents. And the interesting thing is that the higher the standing of the parents in the community, the higher their education or income level, the less chance there was that anyone was going to address their child's behavior. Right? So that the more highly esteemed these parents were in the community, the less often were any teachers or psychologists or neighbors going to say anything about their child because they didn't want to upset the parents, or they felt the parents were so highly educated or wealthy that they would already know about this. Like somehow being considered a mover and shaker in our community prevented these parents from getting the information. My point is, we have a failure to communicate about concerns that we see in children, and that's where we fail them across the board, not just when it becomes gun violence, but when it comes to anxiety and depression, bullying on school campuses. We have policies on our campuses that prevent mental health providers and teachers and counselors from all talking to each other. We don't have MDs talking to therapists. We don't have neighbors talking to parents. And that's where we fail our children across the board. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, I am listening to what you're having to say and going, this is a far more complex question than I think originally was asked.
Okay.
My question is, and you just were approaching that, was that are there studies that show that there are kids who do act out violently using other tools? And I have to agree with the gentleman called in because he said that the media does what it does. Mm-hmm. My point here is that the person, well, I forget his name, but the kid that killed the people in Santa Barbara last spring, mm-hmm. You only hear about gun violence. Mm-hmm. You don't hear about the first three who died via machete. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear about the ones that died via a car. You only hear about the guns. So are there other instances in the country where have lots of people have been injured or killed by these, what we would call our mentally disturbed, I guess, that is not being reported because it's not sensational enough, i.e. guns, to make the news?
Well, and that's a good question, Bill. And I don't think I have, you know, I don't think I have enough research to answer that with any certainty. But I can tell you that in some of the work I did, I was looking at the names of all of these young men who had killed other people while on medications. And there was definitely a few. Jared Victor, who was 15, was on Paxil, stabbed his grandmother. You know, so there are stabbings and there are other ways that people act out violently. Another student was on Prozac and Ritalin, and he came home from work and used a sledgehammer, a hatchet, a butcher knife, and a mechanics file, attacking his younger brothers and sisters. So we do see acts of violence with different weapons. Why we focus on the gun violence, I don't know. Maybe because there isn't enough airtime in the daily news to cover every act of violence that happens, which is probably even more disturbing. And I think, you know, as always, because the whole topic of gun violence is so prevalent in our society, you know, that we go there, right? It's like talking about abortion. They're hotbed issues. And so it gets a lot of media attention because it strikes nerves in people on both ends of the conversation, right? So I think that's why we don't hear about it. But it doesn't mean that if we eliminated all guns that we would stop having these violent eruptions. And I think that's the bigger issue from my perspective, is that we see these psychosocial factors that are leading to these violent outbursts, the gun violence or other violence with different weapons. And we can address these psychosocial problems. They're very easy to address, and yet we spend so much time wrapped up in gun violence and mental illness and, you know, treating bipolar and schizophrenia as if that's going to prevent gun violence, that we miss the obvious, which are these very simple psychosocial problems. Did I cover it for you?
I am in complete agreement with you.
Thanks for taking the time to call in. Hi, Roger. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to get the best site to pull up. Maybe it's your site on the web for the direct connection between the people. Well, at least the fact that the shooters were on these doctor drugs, these Ritalin and Zoloft and Paxil. Could I pull up your site? And would it be written out somewhere, or is there another site, or does that have to be by the book Catherine Newman, Rampage?
No, you can. Her book doesn't really even talk about it. Those are different. Jeffrey Swanson's work is one area that I did some research. Catherine Newman's book is another area I did research. And then the information, where, as I said, I wanted to go because it's always been my bias that the prescription meds drive a lot of these young people to being violent. That information is just a few Google searches and a couple of different websites. And I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but it was very easy to pull up the list of these young people and what drugs they were on. It's very easy to find.
Okay. Do you have a site where one can pull up basically what you have said, and I could use that to reference and be my citation?
As I said, Catherine Newman's and Jerry Swanson's the other one I don't have in front of me at this moment. But if you look
just for yourself.
Oh, my own personal site?
I don't really listen to these programs that much. I just caught you by chance.
Oh, good.
But what you say rings so true. Mm-hmm. What little I have paid attention to those events, you have to read behind the lines sometime. Yeah, most of them were on what I call dangerous, addicting doctor drugs of various sorts and had terrifically bad side effects. Mm-hmm. But could I pull that up? Do you have like a website that you would have your findings that I could simply pull it up there?
I have thereluctanttherapist.com, and I will take some time to share my links. I don't think I have them up there now. And also a Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. And even if you send me a note through the Facebook page or an email to Elizabeth at The Reluctant Therapist, I'm happy to send you what I have.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in. Thanks for listening, Roger. Tune in again.
Okay.
Hi, Todd. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, thanks for bringing up this topic. I think it's important. And obviously, there's been so many shootings in the news now, and very sadly, many police officers. It's a separate issue, but police officers' interactions with people and the shootings of police officers by two civilians, you know, and then now some of them getting shot. So just, I think we live in a generally violent society. I don't know what the statistics are worldwide. I did read, I think, last couple of days that we have 5% of the world's population, and we have 31% of gun deaths. That probably includes suicide and all that. So I don't have any solutions or anything, but I wanted to just say that I agree with you that a big factor beside mental illness, and there's a big gradient of that, is the disconnection of people, young people, but even older people, feeling not connected to their society. And that's something I think we can all do a little bit about just in our daily lives as we go about interacting with people we know and we don't know, mm-hmm. is trying to include people and make them feel that they're part of our community and that their lives are, we all have value, that we all have value.
Well, and I keep thinking, because you brought up the elderly population also, because the highest rate of suicide is actually elderly men who get to a point where they feel marginalized and disconnected from society, and especially once they retire and they feel like they've already, they've spent their purpose in life. And I always imagine that the conversation we should be having is, how do we connect our elders with our young people? Because the parents are working and trying to provide for the family and kind of caught up in their day to day. And so young people, we send them off to school and hope that they're going to make friends, and I'm too busy. And then the elderly kind of get shuffled to the side. There's a natural connection between these two parts of our population. And, in the good old days when we lived in smaller, tighter family communities, you had grandparents with young people, and that's how you could keep both of them engaged and connected to culture. And I really believe that we could reduce greatly acts of violence if young men especially had a greater connection to something outside of themselves and a greater definition of what it is to be a man in our culture. Who's nurturing young men? We teach.
Exactly. That's a great point. And if you'll write a grant for that, I'll do it. I'd like to do something like that. I worked previously in my career with youth with challenges and stuff, and I just think there's a great gap there where a lot of those, especially like you say, young men don't have value because maybe they don't have the greatest upbringing or whatever. Many of them that get into crime or in trouble don't have the greatest role models, and if they had some seniors who they could look up to and also feel like needed them and they could help them out, help them shop, help them spend time with them, it would make a big difference. So that's an area where I think someone could write a grant or whatever, get some kind of program. As far as I know, there's not a program like that in this county.
Well, and if Adam Lanza had something to come home to, right, instead of video games and being by himself, if he'd had someone teaching him how to do a skill or a trade or build something,
exactly.
Or even nurturing animals, caring for someone. We don't even allow young men, to envelop their nurturing tendencies. So I think we're talking about not only the psychosocial problems of communities that are too tightly knit, that don't have room for the awkward, shy kids. We're talking about a community that doesn't talk, that counselors and teachers and parents and friends don't say, hey, I'm worried about your son. Maybe I can help him out, take him for some ice cream. We don't also have a community that has a broad enough definition of what it is to be a young man.
Exactly. And there's a lot of variation on that now. Everybody wants to have their own, it's like there's no set way. But the ones that are the real outliers, and especially if they've had some, abuse in their life, maybe from a father or something, they are vulnerable. They're very vulnerable to feel disconnected and therefore more likely to, be violent if they feel like they have nothing to lose and they have nothing, I can't make in this society. Maybe I don't read well. Maybe school's not for me. So I'm not going to college. I can't get a good job. And, race comes into that as well. Socioeconomic status and race are also factors.
Well, and that's, you brought up what was the greatest indicator of future violence is past violence. That aside from mental illness, aside from all these factors, Swanson's study, Newman's book both said that if a young person has been victimized or a part of a violent act when they're young or has participated in violent acts when they're young are the greatest indicators of potential violence in the future. And so that's something that we can address. That is something that we should be talking about.
and the resources need to be developed, and I guess we as a society have to push the people that we elect and the people that govern, so to speak, to put more resources in that direction. I think there is a little bit of a hope there. I know the criminal justice system has been making some science-based changes. There's a lot of room to go. In fact, it was earlier today on Amy Goodman, a guy who went to prison. Mr. Smith goes to prison. Mm-hmm. A guy who was kind of a legislator. He actually went to prison, but then he commented on, well, we send people to prison, but then we expect them to come out and be part of our society and blend in and get a job. They're felons. They're, you know, they have addiction or all these problems. We do very little. They're starting to do a little bit more, but we're doing very little for people who are very vulnerable in our society.
Well, and I think that, you know, again, it's a whole holistic approach that we have great starts in a lot of areas, right? So we have these meds that we have been developed to address things like ADHD or depression or anxiety. And so all of a sudden the thought is, oh, great, we have this taken care of. So we'll get everyone who's diagnosed on these meds and they're taken care of, right? So that little box is checked. Or someone who's committed a crime, we send them to jail and they serve their time and that's taken care of. But we don't look at anything holistically, that we are more than just one instance, that, you know, anxiety and depression are more often social issues than biological issues. They're, as a matter of fact, not a biological issue at all. They're very much social issues. So unless we change the social environment of the person struggling with anxiety and depression, the meds will do nothing. They might tamper the symptoms, but they don't heal the social issues. And it's the same with our prison population. For those who commit crimes, if we don't change their social environment, poverty, oppression, racism, we will never solve the problem. So to me, the frustration is that it's one more step or two. It's not a million different things. It's a couple more steps to address these social issues that would make the biggest difference.
You're right. It's holistic, and that takes effort, and it takes resources, including money. And the general public is very ignorant about the whole system, the whole criminal justice system, the mental health system, and sometimes have a bit of a fear about it, in fact. But it affects all of us, and with all these gun deaths and violence in our society, it's something that we definitely should prioritize and spend more time on. Thank you for your show. You do a great job.
Thank you, Todd, for calling in. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. If you're just tuning in, I kind of broached the subject today about gun violence and mental illness, and I had wanted to make a link between mental illness leading to gun violence. And there are, you know, there are the statistics about those who have been violent who were on prescription medications. But also we have to be careful to note that we're not talking about people who struggle with severe mental illness like schizophrenia, psychosis, or bipolar disorder. These people do not tend to be more violent than anyone else on the spectrum. But one of my concerns is that we don't look at mental health on a spectrum. We're lumping everyone who struggles with anything from anxiety to grief to trauma to bipolar disorder as all having the same level of mental discomfort or mental disease, mental disorder. And then we have to understand the spectrum so that we treat people more in a more nuanced fashion. And we also have to start addressing the psychosocial issues, the greater issues. For example, our school district is getting ready to continue their connection with outsourcing mental health resources on the high school campus, that they're, you know, having a partnership with local agencies so that when a student is identified as struggling with anxiety or depression or some mental health concern, they're sending these young students out to these other agencies for treatment. It sounds great on the surface. It looks like a great opportunity, a great program, you know, serving a need. The problem is the agencies in turn do not communicate back with the schools. So the school never finds out if the young person received services or how they're doing or what the concerns are. The school can't communicate with the agency. The teachers don't communicate with the agencies. Quite often parents don't communicate with the agencies. And so we again lose children within the system that we think we're providing this care, but it's not a holistic amount of care. In order to really serve those who are alienated, marginalized, outcast, feeling less than, we have to somehow create a safety net of communication around them. You know, why does the United States have a higher level of anxiety and depression than other Western cultures or other cultures around the world, because we are the most isolated. We're the most individualistic. We are not a collectivistic culture. We expect that everyone's going to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And, you know, if you try hard enough, you can be a winner. And, you know, everyone should fight to find their place. Well, that's not realistic. A great deal of our population is always going to need help, is going to need support. There are times in all of our lives when we need to be surrounded by a net of comfort and care. And until we recognize that and make time for that, and until we start to provide caregivers with the ability to care for others by paying them more, by recognizing their value in society, we're going to continue losing people. We're especially going to lose young men. And young men are the most they have the highest tendency towards violent behavior when they feel marginalized or ostracized or awkward. Young girls tend to fall into deep depression, eating disorders, self-harm, much more than young men. But it doesn't mean that young women don't also struggle with feeling marginalized or oppressed or ignored or invisible. And again, I bring this up because our small communities, we're not a big city, but our small communities are at higher risk for these gun violent episodes than bigger cities, because it is easier in these idyllic small towns to get lost, to assume that our children are growing up with the best of everything. We think that we can insulate ourselves by making a certain amount of money or living in a very nice home or sending our children to private schools. We think we can insulate ourselves from mental health issues or from violence, but we can't. We actually set ourselves up for greater problems when we think that we are immune to having mental health issues become a part of our life. And the other thing for parents to understand is that when your child is struggling with depression, anxiety, acting out, oppositional defiant disorder, we need to spend a lot more time looking at their social environment and not immediately considering that it's some sort of biological deficit, because 90% of the time it's not. 1% of our children who are diagnosed have a diagnosable disease, 1%, a diagnosable disorder. That means if we're medicating 14% of our children, 13% of our children are being diagnosed with something that should not be medicated. That means we need to do a better job talking. And if you are a teacher or a friend or a neighbor who recognizes that a child in your neighborhood is struggling, you have to speak out. You have to talk to their parents and keep talking or go to the school. And until we surround this child with understanding and support, we are part of the problem. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I appreciate, as always, all of the callers and your thoughts and your wisdom, your support for this program. You can continue the conversation on my Facebook page, an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. We will be on iTunes. Previous shows are at kcbx.org. Next week, we will be talking about sex ed in our young people's lives, and I hope you'll tune in, because I think it's another topic that is fundamental in the mental health and well-being of all of our society, but especially those who are the most vulnerable. Thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.